Today in Studio 360, we are ditching the totally sentimental this Valentine's Day. I'll talk with the rock singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel. And watch out, you just might fall for her and her bittersweet love songs.
The sort of melancholy moments are a little bit more fun than usual.
There are two kinds of men. He could never be true. But am I just like him? Am I unfaithful too?
And we'll hear from two authors, husband and wife, who are not quite feeling the love.
You see, I'm a fiction writer. If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
He prefers poems with a good, clear moral, or a beautiful but disfigured nun, and a bit of the old boom-chaka-boom-chaka-boom-boom-boom.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Tired of greeting card and flower merchandisers nudging you into celebrating Valentine's Day in the standard, sickly sweet fashion? Yeah, us too. So, we've got a special treat. The singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel.
I wonder how you look when you sleep. Do you still dream about girls from your street? Do you still dream about girls from high school? Do you still dream about girls, girls, girls?
For more than a decade, she's been crafting and singing perfect breakup anthems and not-so-lovey-dovey love songs. She has bounced from jazz to country to torchy pop to hard-edge rock and roll, sometimes on the very same record. It is not many performers who get compared to Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders and to Patsy Cline. Mandel's new record is called Artificial Fire. It's her seventh full-length CD, and it comes out later this month. And she is here today with her band, Eleni Mandel. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
And before we talk some, I would love to have you play a song off this record. What are you going to play?
We're going to play Artificial Fire.
Which is the name of the record.
Indeed.
Artificial fire.
That was great. That was Eleni Mandel singing the title track off her new CD, Artificial Fire. Eleni, before we go on, can you introduce the members of your band?
With pleasure. It's Jeremy Drake on the guitar, Ryan Fevis on the bass, and Kevin Fitzgerald on the drums.
You live in Los Angeles. You grew up here in the San Fernando Valley, which, for those who don't know, is this vast stretch, stereotypically uncool, middle-class suburban part of L.A. Did you grow up in a musical family?
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say yes. My mother played the piano, my sister played the piano, and my brother was forced to play the piano. And I played violin and piano. And then when I was 13, I discovered punk rock, and that was the beginning. That was when a light went off.
And so you became sort of a Valley punk girl?
Yeah, well, X, you know, was sort of the first band that made me say, wow, I want to do that.
And they were the punk band of
L.A., yeah.
Los
Angeles. And it's such a unique sound. I'd never heard a combination of sounds like that before. And I walked down to the boulevard, Ventura Boulevard, and rented myself a guitar. So taking the initiative, knowing that there was something there I needed to find, was a big moment, for sure.
And was the music you started playing your version of X?
Yeah, completely. I would make my teacher teach me X songs.
Do you think Los Angeles shapes your sensibility?
Absolutely.
How?
I felt like when growing up in sort of this vast, empty, sunny, weird, you know, not weird place made me really want to look for adventure and you know, take the bus over the hill and find some crazy people to hang out with. And I would say, you know, Tom Waits being a big influence, uh-huh. He recorded a lot of records here and wrote about Los Angeles, and not just his music, which shaped me, but also reading books that, you know, were written here, Bukowski and Ask the Dust. And
so the noirish side of,
yeah,
L.A.?
Definitely. I was very attracted to that, and I think I sort of see the world that way.
I would love to hear another song, if you could play one.
Love to.
What is this?
This is called Personal.
My eyes are the color of martini olives. I only drink two, never three. My hair is plain brown. Once I was blonde, yellow. Not to it. I like to drink coffee with one cube of sugar, always with cream and never with milk, only dark chocolate. I really love summer. I love to be warm. I love to feel. Thank you.
That is Eleni Mandel and her band performing the song Personal live here in Studio 360 on the road in Los Angeles. This album took you a while to make. Did you have a sort of overarching notion of, here's what I want to do with this record that I haven't done in the half dozen or more previous ones?
Yeah, I definitely knew that I wanted to have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Even the sort of melancholy moments are a little bit more fun than usual.
And that's a result of these wonderful times in which we live?
I was realizing more and more how much different kinds of music had been an influence on me since I was a kid, and really exploring these other influences like Joan Jett, Adam and the Ants, the English Beat, you know, stuff I'd kind of forgotten about.
Forgotten about or thought, oh, that's too uncool, I can't let that get in there?
Well, I definitely had this notion when I was much younger that being uncommercial was really cool. And as I struggled through my uncommercial years, I started thinking, you know what? It's not bad to be able to hum a song and dance to it and make other people happy and just have a great time at a show.
The singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel is my guest. And coming up, Mandel gets really commercial and a little controversial.
You could think that she was selling a soft porn video or Girls Gone Wild tape.
Paris Hilton, fast food burgers, and more Eleni Mandel, all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The incredibly versatile singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel is my guest today.
I love Paris and the
spring. A few years ago, she was asked to sing the jazz standard I Love Paris for a Carl's Jr. hamburger commercial. She took the gig.
I love Paris in the winter when it drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles.
Well, it turns out that in the commercial, Paris was a half-naked Paris Hilton who spends the entire ad washing her car and herself with a soapy sponge before she eats a hamburger.
If you didn't see the Carl's Jr. tag at the end, you wouldn't know what she was trying to sell. You could think that she was selling a soft porn video or Girls Gone Wild tape.
The commercial was so scandalous in some parts of the country that it was actually banned from the airwaves.
I loved doing the song. I love, you know, being called in and, you know, it's a job and I love to sing. So for me, it was sort of a challenging, weird opportunity to do something I wouldn't normally do. And I also thought no one would ever know it was me.
And the song was the wonderful Cole Porter song, I Love Paris,
yeah.
Not done as Cole Porter probably ever imagined it would be done.
Yeah.
Had you covered that or was that some advertising genius's idea?
That was their idea.
Yeah.
That was an assignment, yeah.
Did you like doing that? Because it sounds really cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved it. I also grew up on jazz standards, so I'm a big Cole Porter fan.
And then once your super ultra indie fan base found out she's on this Carl Jr.'s commercial, in this day and age, does that not matter or was there like negative reaction?
I did hear a couple negative comments, more from a few people that I admire, which was really hard. But then, you know, I thought, well, this is okay. I don't have to agree with them.
And the negative was just, the way you performed the song, or she's a sellout.
It was more of a sellout thing.
Yeah.
That you shouldn't be contributing to advertising.
That's pretty hardcore at this point. I thought in the age of Moby, that was all okay now.
I think it is okay, and it took me aback for a minute, thinking, wow, this person that I, care about and, you know, I hold in high regard, doesn't agree with what I've done, but also, you know, I used to be sort of snobby about pairing music, art with commercial and advertising, but it's kind of the only way you can keep going, and I want to keep going.
Before we finish today, Can you play another song?
I would love to. This is called It Wasn't the Time, It Was the Color.
It wasn't the time, it was the color. My mother wore a yellow dress, carrying my brother. The summer always stung bright like metal. The bank was built with green glass. I felt so forgettable. Brown sofa, the summer always hot, white and still. He asked if I would kiss him goodbye.
That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today.
Real pleasure.
Eleni Mandel's new record is called Artificial Fire. And at studio360.org, you can find out where Eleni and the band are performing on their tour and hear another song they performed live just for us. A couple of weeks ago, we invited you to submit an original haiku inspired by the state of the economy. We decided to call up the writers of a few of our favorites, although many of you chose to ignore the traditional 5-7-5 structure.
My name is Don Ebel, and I live in Vancouver, Washington. I just happened to be working late and driving home and heard the invitation to send in a haiku, and I thought, oh, I've got the perfect one. Man turns over a new leaf, not realizing he lives inside a jungle.
I'm Amy Holman. I live in Brooklyn, New York. The sawing bus melts the snowy streets. Out of cash and card, I take warmth. I had to have a little optimism, so I went with the warmth of the bus.
This is Barry Goodman. I live in Hackensack, New Jersey. I was laid off with a bunch of people in the marketing department of a big company, And you know, I spoke to my boss sometime after the layoff, and she told me she sat in an adjacent cubicle, and she would sometimes talk to me in the, you know, my old cube, and then she forgot I was not there anymore. My old boss talks to an empty cubicle, the autumn wind.
Hi, this is Stephen Horowitz. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. As somebody who works in the bankruptcy field and used to be a bankruptcy lawyer myself, I'd always wanted to come up with a creative outlet in a dry and esoteric field. Indignation and litigation, all for 2 cents on the dollar.
I'm Ellen Diamond, and I'm from New York City. I've been reading and writing haiku since I was a young girl, and I've always found it a wonderful way to say what you want to say without getting all mushy about it. Everything in ruin, true, but in the winter sky, there she is, the moon. Will this ever end? Will spring find her way again? Time to call a friend.
Thanks to everybody who sent in their poems. Do you have a haiku about the economy? If so, submit it at our website, studio360.org. My wife, Anne, and I are both writers. For the record, neither of us write much haiku. But the writing that each of us does is very different. So I was interested when I heard about Naeem Murr and his wife, Averill Kurdi. Naeem is a novelist. Averill is a poet. When the Poetry Foundation in Chicago commissioned a story from him about what it's like to be married to a poet, he welcomed the challenge.
I've never understood poetry. You see, I'm a fiction writer. If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
So given that Naeem wrote this satirical and slightly antagonistic account of life with his poet wife, we thought it's only fair to hear the other side of the story from Averill Kurdi.
For now, I will consider my novelist. For at dawn's grumbling of the L in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by grinding the beans and making me coffee. For in these few minutes, an elegantly fragrant silence reigns.
Loving my poet as I do, I try hard to understand what a poet is. The first clue lies in the fact that my poet, every poet, is an insomniac. A friend of mine, who's a literature professor, is very enamored of my poet, whom he describes tremblingly as the real thing. The real thing. He tells me he finds it profoundly reassuring that while we ordinary mortals are asleep, there exist lit rooms containing anxious, vigilant souls. A terrible responsibility, he says, devolves upon the poet that requires her never to be fully awake or asleep. The world will end, he once told me, when the final poet awake closes her eyes. Last night I woke up sweating, having dreamed of sinking with the rest of humanity into cold oblivion. Sure enough, my poet was fast asleep beside me, the first deep sleep she'd entered in more than a week. So I knocked a pile of books to the floor and returned to my blissful slumbers, much comforted by the thought that at least one poet would wander the midnight battlements, keep watch, and preserve us all for one more day.
My novelist's prompt and voluble good cheer in the morning strains my very last nerve. For doesn't he know we are all going to die? As he senses the magnanimous motions of his muse beginning within, my novelist burps. Now lightened in spirit, he scrawls on the door to his office, writer at work, no girls allowed. For he weeps for his characters, then pokes his head into my office, smiling to ask,
"You're not working, are you?" Having written 36 pages or so this morning, I take a break and seek out my poet. She's in the sitting room, leaning her forehead hopelessly against the window pane, staring into the street. Finished any poems?
Not today.
What, no signal again? I make the call me gesture and wander around the sitting room, saying, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" She tells me quietly that if I don't leave her alone, she's going to disembowel me with her pencil. I lay low for a bit, and then very quietly carry my chair into the sitting room. She's still staring out of the window, unmoved. I get up onto the chair with my manuscript, which I lift as high as I can, before dropping. "Oh, I didn't mean to disturb you," I say. "Just wanted to get a sense of the heft of this new novel. It's a whopper."
Always he asks of each of my poems, "But what does it mean?" "For a poem should not mean but be," I intone. For he says, "Yes, be pretty." "No, for I like poems oblique as the reverse of antique tapestries and hard enough to crack a tooth on." For my novelist adds that he prefers poems with a good, clear moral, or a beautiful but disfigured nun, and a bit of the old boom-chaka-boom-chaka-boom-boom-boom. Still gyrating his hips and giggling, he makes oatmeal for breakfast. For he writes only 50 pages before breakfast, and so worries he's suffering writer's block, which he's pretty sure he caught from a toilet seat.
My poet actually did start to get the signal this morning and spent almost 6 hours scribbling in her notebook. The result? 10 lines on a single page. That page is now impaled upon her corkboard, trapped in a terrible limbo with her other poems in progress, some of them years old and countless drafts thick. I find her reading in her office and ask what her new poem is about.
"That starling we saw, the one trapped in the Amtrak station."
"And?"
"And that's what it's about."
"So a tale of triumph, little guy against the corporate machine."
"No, via negativa, apophasis. I'm thinking of what it's not."
What is not?"
"What the starling is not."
She points at her corkboard.
"Why don't you just read it?"
I do. And for a moment, I feel as if the top of my head has come off. Immediately followed by the rather unpleasant sensation that someone's rattling a stick around in there. "Whoa," I say. "Deep." I pretend to stagger for a while under the weight of its profundity. Feeling I've done my duty, I ask if I can tell her the plot of my new novel.
"If you must,"
she says, with that expression of desperate eagerness very particular to her, and strangely reminiscent of most people's expressions when they're not very eager at all. "A woman has 2 children, a boy and a girl." I start to cry, but hold off. "And she dies from the cancer."
"What kind of cancer?"
"Cancer of the left ventricle." The key to good fiction is being specific. "And her son becomes a boxer because he's full of anger at God. And her daughter becomes a nun, chaste, but under her cassock..."
"Habit."
"What?"
"Nuns wear habits."
"Why are you saying things I can't understand?" "Anyway, her loveliness is wasted because her cassock catches fire and she becomes horribly disfigured."
"Stop."
"Mildly disfigured?"
"Just stop, please."
"A small scar that's actually quite becoming?"
"This is exactly the same as your other novel."
I can see she's in pain. My plots always move her. I don't get why poems can't have such stirring plots. Her poem is about what a starling is not. It seems to me that in a way all poems are about what a starling is not. Where's the passion, the triumph, human will overcoming tragedy and breaching the indifferent, where disfigured nuns cast off their cassocks to bare their beauty, where boxers beat men to a bloody pulp and cry up to heaven, "Here, here, damn you, is the work of my hands." "A starling," I say.
"A starling? Why don't I just pop them out," he wonders. For he writes the story, and I write the song of the story. Plot bores me. He can have it. For who wants to worry always about this and then that and then this, when we are all going to die?
I don't know if this is one of the reasons my professor friend calls her the real thing. But my poet loves words in a way that I feel is quite unhealthy and unnatural. She owns a dictionary decades old and so large she uses a small buffet cart to wheel it around our apartment like some invalid relative. The secret to a poet's soul lies somewhere in the little cells of that dungeonish dictionary, in the slow languishing of those old, mad, forgotten words. It's also in the very particular kind of art she and every poet seems to love. Joseph Cornell. I guarantee you will not find a single poet who doesn't start rubbing herself against the furniture the minute you mention Cornell and his little boxes full of human residue, the pleasures of the miniature. One good thing, though, is that after we went to see the Cornell exhibit some years ago, I got the idea to give her, for her birthday, a tobacco box in which I'd glued lots of small objects, secret decoder rings, vintage bottle caps, my grandfather's glass eye. She gushed. Like a Cornell, I pointed out.
I love it because you made it.
It's just like a Cornell.
You usually just give me cash.
Isn't it exactly like a Cornell?
I love it. Thank you.
Since then, that's what I've given her for every present. Small things glued into boxes, shoe boxes, cereal boxes, bento boxes, Happy Meal boxes. She does seem a little less enthusiastic.
For he is my dream of an old house. In my dream, I have lived in this house for years. When I open a door I've never seen before and enter a room filled with comforts and curiosities, a fox's spine strung within a bell jar, a doll's head crowned by a hive of honeybees. For this is how it feels when I read my novelist's new book. For then my next poem, trembling now like the meniscus upon a glut cup, now full as a melting icicle's bleb showing the inverted world, my next poem will be an elegy infused with beauty and sorrow and the awareness that we are all going to die. Just write it, he says, spill it out, as though a poem is ever just written. Why don't I just write it? Well, I'll tell you. Because I am the cavalry charge into the cannon's maw, the winning run thrown out at home, the heroic yet impotent gesture.
My poet is in the sitting room with her forehead pressed to the window again. It's actually been a good week for us. I sold my new novel after a bidding war for $11 million, and my poet had a poem taken by a well-known literary journal, which gave payment in the form of an origami swan made out of her recycled submission. But I've been feeling contrite. I forgot our anniversary in January. Quietly, I approach my poet, who is lost in thought. In truth, health, riches, and a vast readership are as nothing compared to this moment. My poet turning to me, her face dilating beautifully as she murmurs like an approaching revelation. Glaucus. But her face soon clouds. Whatever it was didn't take hold, and the abortive flush of it leaves her sad and drawn. This seems a good time to hand her my anniversary gift. I'm sorry it's late. As she unwraps it, I walk away.
What's this?
She calls after me. A Cornell, I say.
Did you make it?
Oh no, that, I say, pointing back at her, at my genuine and indisputable poet. That is the real thing.
For it is Valentine's Day, and this morning a new poem, more visionary than Dante's Inferno, more definitive than the wasteland, seeps into every cell of my body when my novelist knocks on the door. With a rose in his mouth and dressed only in a ribbon, he asks,
"You weren't planning to work today, were you?"
Naeem Murr's novel is called The Perfect Man, and Averil Kurdi's poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine and the Paris Review. Portions of our piece originally appeared in a podcast from the Poetry Foundation. And our story was produced by Studio 360's Pike Malinowski. Do you happen to be an artist living with another artist? If so, tell us about your happy home and or your creative clashes at studio360.org. Coming up, she's turning 50 this year, but she really hasn't aged a bit.
In many ways, she actually hasn't aged incredibly well. She's kept her figure, first and foremost, and her hair and her makeup, and she doesn't look a day older.
We look at how and why Barbie became an American icon.
We used to have, like, a giant box of naked Barbie.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
I hope everything's all right with you. Maybe I should go and see about you. Collect some love, if you don't mind.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. One of my most vivid memories as a parent is the day about a dozen years ago when my little girls ceremoniously laid out all their Barbie dolls on the street in front of our house. Then they had me run over them repeatedly with the car.
Here are five of your favorite friends, Barbie, Midge, Skipper, Alan, and Ken. But if you think they're the same as they've always been, you'd better take another look. Better check them again.
Barbie turns 50 this year, so she has endured 5 decades of mutilations and knockoffs and spin-offs. For our series on American icons, Studio 360's Lital Molad looks into how Barbie still looms large in the American psyche.
We are so excited to have a play day with Barbies together.
We used to have, like, a giant box of naked Barbies.
My favorite Barbie is a Pocahontas. She's, like, my only Native American Barbie.
I name her Vanessa.
I named her Jennifer. I just don't know why.
She has nice eyelashes.
They would all take her clothes off, sort of reflexively, like they didn't even know that they were doing it.
Is there anything I dislike about the doll? Yeah, it's really hard to get hose on.
Barbies are for everybody, boys and girls, teenagers, little kids, everybody, even grown-ups.
I played with Barbie even though I was a tomboy. What 10-year-old girl in the 80s could resist Barbie and the Rockers?
Barbie and the Rockers!
Eventually, my little sister inherited them, along with her 27 other Barbies. One day, I decided she had plenty, and that some of them needed new haircuts. You know, like mohawks. My sister didn't agree. It turns out Shelley's Barbie excess was pretty normal. The average American girl owns 10 Barbies, and every second, 2 Barbie dolls are sold somewhere in the world.
Barbie came in 1959 and just decimated the other dolls.
Susan Stern is the director and writer of the documentary called Barbie Nation.
Barbie Nation was prompted by my daughter, who was about 3 years old at that time. And she had invented this game she called Jealous Barbie. And that's where my doll had to be jealous of her doll because her doll had everything better, better hair, better car, better guy. And I just, you know, this gave me pause. I sat her down. And I gave her, you know, Feminist Lecture 304, which is women don't have to be jealous of other women. And she just looked at me and then said, okay, Mom, how about if first we play what I want to play and then we can play what you want to play? And soon I realized that everybody had a Barbie story and they were really about us and not about Barbie.
Barbie was invented by Ruth Handler. She ran the Mattel company with her husband until the mid-70s. Handler found her inspiration for Barbie when she spotted a doll in a store window in Europe. Its name was Lily. M.G. Lord wrote the book Forever Barbie, the unauthorized biography of a real doll.
Lily basically was, I'm searching for euphemisms, but German streetwalker is what comes to mind.
Lily was a sexy novelty gift for grown men, based on a character in a raunchy comic strip. So why did Ruth Handler think she could sell this doll to American kids? She'd seen her daughter Barbara playing with paper dolls and fantasizing about adult life, something she couldn't do with childlike dolls. So Lily was exactly what Handler had been looking for, a doll with a woman's figure that could beautifully show off grown-up clothes.
As pieces of sculpture, Lily and Barbie are so close as to be virtually indistinguishable.
In Mattel's early marketing tests, a lot of mothers were uncomfortable with the doll, but girls loved it. M.G. Lord says that the company overcame this by advertising directly to kids on TV. and by making Barbie a proper young fashion model.
Barbie had the wholesome American girl personality invented for her, and it was kind of perfect for what was expected of women in terms of sexuality at the time when Barbie appeared. Women were expected to look highly sexual, but to comport themselves like these wacky Doris Day virgins in the movies. You know,
the whole virgin horror complex?
Exactly. The tarted up girl next door.
Susan Stern.
I'm old enough to have had the original Barbie when she came out in 1959. You know, back in 1959, the only place that a kid ever saw a woman's breasts was in National Geographic. But other than that, Barbie's breasts were kind of fun and were a revelation. So I found the Barbie doll very sexy and liked to dress her up in all the wonderful outfits as well.
The outfits really were incredible. Ensembles like Gay Parisienne and Roman Holiday were made of cotton, silk, and corduroy with real zippers and linings, matching purses and gloves.
I can still feel them in my fingertips, feel playing with those things.
But Barbie's wardrobe wasn't just about a life of leisure. There was stewardess Barbie, registered nurse Barbie, student teacher Barbie, and even Miss Astronaut Barbie in 1965.
One could very easily make a feminist argument for her. I mean, she was a flight attendant at one point, but then she was also a pilot.
Stephen Dubin is a sociologist at Teachers College of Columbia University.
The fact that she never got married, I mean, she was, you know, she's like Mary Tyler Moore in that sense. She was a career woman, and that she really relished being an independent woman.
Certainly in the early 1960s, Barbie was very destabilizing to the middle-class nuclear family. She suggested a whole other way of being in the world to little girls. Her message was very much like that of Helen Gurley Brown's Sex and the Single Girl that came out, I believe, in 1962. Which, despite its breathy prose, was very much an anti-marriage manifesto and an argument for women's financial and sexual autonomy.
Here I come.
But to feminists in the 70s, Barbie represented the stereotype that they were fighting against. The National Organization for Women criticized Mattel for sexist advertising. They passed out leaflets at the 1972 toy fair that said Barbie dolls encouraged girls to, quote, see themselves solely as mannequins, sex objects, or housekeepers. Mattel tried things like flattening Barbie's feet in 1970 so that she could wear sensible shoes, but that product failed. Keeping up with the times wasn't that easy, and the 70s were hard on Barbie. But by 1992, the doll was making more than $1 billion a year. Still, a popular girl is easy to hate. Defiling Barbie seems to be a rite of passage for kids, and a creative way for grown-ups to make a point. Professor Dubin.
Anytime you've got something which seems to solidify what an ideal form is supposed to be, you know, you had Venus de Milo in the past, now you've got Barbie. It's the perfect thing for artists to play with, and the fact that gender has become so disputed, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, it's a gift to artists, in fact.
In 1987, Todd Haynes made a movie called Superstar. It was about the singer Karen Carpenter's battle with anorexia. He shot the movie entirely with Barbie dolls as puppets. It may sound silly, but it's actually pretty disturbing.
Karen? I think she's coming too.
Karen?
Where am I? You're in the hospital, dear.
You collapsed on stage.
From exhaustion and malnutrition.
You'll be here 5 more days.
Then home for plenty of rest.
You're going to be under Mom's constant care.
I'll cook for you.
She's going to fatten you up.
No more dieting.
No more laxatives.
And we'll all be together again.
I'm dating Barbie. 3 afternoons a week, while my sister is at dance class, I take Barbie away from Ken. I'm practicing for the future.
That's the novelist A.M. Holmes reading from her story, A Real Doll. It's about an adolescent boy who develops a rather intimate relationship with his sister's Barbie.
On the way back to Jennifer's room, I did something Barbie almost didn't forgive me for. I did something which not only shattered the moment, but nearly wrecked the possibility of our having a future together. In the hallway between the stairs and Jennifer's room, I popped Barbie's head into my mouth, like Lion and Tamer. God and Godzilla. I popped her whole head into my mouth, and Barbie's hair separated into single strands like Christmas tinsel and caught in my throat, nearly choking me.
Mattel doesn't like to see Barbie in compromising positions. The company sued the photographer Tom Forsyth for his series called Food Chain Barbie. In the photos, Barbie is posed naked with various kitchen appliances.
I was looking at these dolls, very brightly lit, and I'm seeing the lights bouncing off of these perky, huge breasts, and I'm seeing the long legs stretching out, and the silly smile that, of course, is just always there. And so I looked at the doll and started to see the impossible sexuality of the doll.
In the picture Barbie Enchiladas, a row of Barbies are lying in an oven, wrapped up in tortillas and covered with sauce.
I put the doll in situations that would be jarring in ways that didn't fit the image Mattel was trying to create for the doll, because I felt that was a false image.
Forsyth won the case under fair use in federal court. I asked Cassidy Park, Mattel's VP of Barbie design, what she thought of people who criticize Barbie's unrealistic image.
I think that Barbie, first of all, she's not a human form. She is a toy form. We've never meant her to replicate a real-life human form. So I know the inspiration and the work that's done here to make sure that Barbie can represent so many different things for girls. We take that very seriously and always want her to be a good role model for girls.
Professor Dubin.
I think we always are looking for single explanations for things. It's very easy to blame anorexia, all kinds of problems with children on one thing. Say, look, these kids grew up with Barbie, as if you only got rid of Barbie, then everything would be right. So this idea of, you know, a passive audience and these huge corporations that are doing these horrible things to us, that doesn't wash with me at all.
And now we've come to a time when Barbie may not even be sexy enough. M.G. Lord.
Now, Barbie's big competitor, these Bratz dolls, are similar to the early Barbie in that they are broad caricatures of hot females.
Who's the hottest princess here? Royal girls have arrived. Bratz princess looks just as
good. The Bratz debuted in 2001. They've got big heads, tiny bodies, and sassy attitudes. And instead of having one white front woman, the Bratz are a multiracial bunch. Mattel's response? It was time for Barbie to get a little bling.
It's My Scene, My Bling.
The new My Scene, My Bling Bling girls are here.
Nice bling.
Here, wear my ring.
Ooh, sparkly.
I watched a very revealing play episode involving the Bratz and Barbies playing together. I mean, they had sort of a family of Bratz dolls living in a house, and one of them was on the roof. And when the doll fell off the roof and hurt himself, who did they summon? They summoned Barbie, Dr. Barbie. They referred to her as Mrs. Smarty Pants. Barbie is an authority figure now. She's associated with Mom, who had Barbies. Mom never had Bratz.
Sure enough, shortly after the release of the Bratz dolls, Barbie sales took a big dip. After a big legal battle last year, Mattel won the rights to Bratz. So Bratz and Barbies are now actually cousins. But even with kids changing their tastes, there are still more than a billion Barbie dolls on the planet.
Hundreds of years from now, when archaeologists are digging around in dumps and so on, they're going to find these strange plastic objects that have refused to disintegrate, and they're going to think, what was this? Because this doesn't look like human beings as we knew them at that time. I mean, Che Guevara, you know, you don't have to know who he was to wear the t-shirt. Marilyn Monroe, who obviously had a very different body type than is popular today, still has that iconic status. Barbie is here to stay. I think there's no doubt that she's here to stay.
Maybe 12-year-olds are still playing with Barbie, but secretly, just like I did. At least until you can hand them down to your little sister and then cut off all their hair. For Studio 360, I'm Lital Malad. Do you remember what I did to your Barbies when I was 14?
Yes.
So have you ever forgiven me for what I did to those dolls?
No.
There's more about Barbie and all of the American icons we've covered, from The Great Gatsby to Gone with the Wind, at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Catherine Epstein,
Kurt Schlachter,
Josie Holtzman,
Nick Haling.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the guy who put the in the Star Wars lightsaber.
Oh, that hum sounds dangerous.
Ben Burtt. He's up for 2 Oscars for his work on the movie WALL-E.
WALL-E's voice starts with my voice. And is highly processed.
Movie sound effects legend Ben Burtt. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.